Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to the El Arpa Media Podcast. Joining me in studio is Mary. How's she cutting? How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. And you?
Thank you, yes. I'm not wanting to stand on ceremony, but a little bit of decorum would be appreciated. Here we are, the last podcast of July. Before we and then we move gingerly into August and then September, and so the whole thing starts again. So we'll start off with the coronavirus, and then we'll talk about Lady Gaga. So not related stories, but some parts of Spain have gone back into maybe different phases of the de-escalation. Rates have tripled. I think it was, 8 per thousand, and now it's gone up to 27 per thousand as well. So there are things that we have to keep an eye on, no? And now this podcast became the coronavirus podcast. We were doing it in different places over Skype and everything, no? And then we had our reunion, and we went to the Prado, and the coronavirus is over, and the sun never set, and the fields were rolling into the distance and the peacocks were frolicking upon said hills. But is there another twist in this tale? The curve is going up again slightly, but are you worried, or how are you seeing the situation?
Yeah, it's a pain.
It's a pain in the arse, yeah. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, exactly. Things got better, but then of course it's a holiday, so everybody started moving around, and then, you know, it was bound to happen. They said it all the time, that there was going to be other breakdowns and new breakdowns and a new wave of...
Outbreaks. Well, the AAA are going to be very busy.
That's purely personal, no. Yeah. We're talking about the outbreaks. And basically, it's just happened. So for now, it's restricted to certain areas. It's not a generic thing, but, you know, we have to be very careful. And then it's just impossible to know where we're going to be in the next few weeks and whether some places are going to have to be confined, or we just don't know.
I think, I don't know for the rest of Spain, but Madrid is definitely quite a lot down this year. Even though we're out and about in the street and have masks, there's a lot less movement, a lot less activity, and things are down. You know, people aren't going to museums as much or doing tours and etc.
Because a lot of things are closed. We've tried going to exhibitions, and it's about the third time we turn up to an exhibition, and it says it's advertised, but then when you go there, they say...
It's closed. No,
we cannot really put it up, so...
Yeah, and now the masks are mandatory all the time, which is another thing, because I know a lot of people... I'm not sure in Spain...
Not in Madrid, though. No. I forgot to tell you.
Not in Madrid.
No, in the end, they haven't made it compulsory every time in Madrid.
I was boiling last Thursday, walking around in a big mask.
No, on Thursday, I did think. That's why I told you. It's just like at the weekend, they said... Because it was like a political thing, and then in the end they decided, no, we don't need to.
You know, an old woman gave out to me, I had my mask. Now, the thing is, my mask application is second to none. I'm on the street.
Ah, your mask application? Have you had an app to control how you put your mask? I'm like, wow.
No, but if I'm on the street and it's a quiet street and there's 2 meters distance between me and the other people, you know, my mask is down, you know?
Yeah.
I'm letting my red beard breed in the sunshine of Madrid. But she gave out to me. She was like, you have to have your mask on, you know? And I was like, I don't think that's right. And she was like...
People were confused, though, because they announced it in the paper as in Thursday, unless this happens, which, to be honest, they were trying to bargain with the thing of the airport, because the local government thinks the central government is not doing enough to protect, you know, new arrivals, people that come from other countries into the airport. There's no control, they say. So then, in a weird twist of events, they say, well, unless you put more control, we're going to make masks compulsory. Which is stupid, because it's a, you know, it's not a a bargaining element that... like, surely it's a good thing. Both things are good things for, like, to protect but citizens.
It's the same in Ireland, though, because I think a lot of Americans are coming over. And what you're seeing here is a very complicated situation, because, like, if an American calls up an Irish hotel, there's no vacancy. Or if they go to a restaurant, they're like, sorry, we don't want to serve you. Because, and I can understand both sides. Obviously, you know, America is a basket case at the moment with the coronavirus, and there is very little in the way of trying to control it. And Donald Trump has, I think, mentally just decided to move on from it as a topic.
Although now he's wearing a mask now in a weird twist of events.
Well, yeah, and then, you know, and then obviously if you're an American and you're on the receiving end of that, that's very uncomfortable and you can feel discriminated against. But I imagine when the coronavirus started, there was very little controls of people coming into the country very recklessly. And they were probably in lots of countries gone back to that, you know. But people, it's very difficult to apply the protocols properly, because there's a very interesting thing in the Irish Times at the weekend about Killarney, which is a very famous tourist town that became very popular when Queen Victoria went there. And now lots of people go there, and it's a very popular destination. There's a huge park there. You can go on these, like, pony and traps. Very scenic, as Kerry is typically. But, you know, you can only, like, in bars, you can only go in and have, you know, have a drink if you get food. But the journalist in question ordered a drink without food. And if you're booking ahead, they can trace you if there's an incident of the coronavirus. But people are walking in off the street. Nothing was exchanged in by way of contact details. Maybe they paid in cash and there's no records. Or they're not traceable. So if somebody walked in there with the coronavirus and infected lots of people, where have they gone to? It's impossible to know, you know. So, but yeah, so it's just a lot of, like, very difficult situations. Nobody knows what they should do. It's very difficult to maybe to apply the protocols properly. But one thing that should be definitely applied are the masks. They're simple to use, and people, I think, have a kind of moral objection to them, you know. But I'll tell you, there's one YouTuber who felt like that as well, and he's like, how dare my government say I have to wear the mask? Who are these totalitarian brutes? But then he got the coronavirus, and this is a very similar story. People who are skeptical about it get it, almost die, see people dying from it, know that they'll take possibly months to recover because they've lost all their muscle mass in hospital. In the case of this guy, that's what happened to him. And then they go, yeah, actually masks make sense. So the prevention, even though it's annoying to have it on your face, and especially on a hot day, is very much better than the cure, no?
Of course.
Not the bands, obviously. But
the weird thing is that, well, it happens with everything in life. You know? There are certain people, unless it happens to them, they're not really aware, or they find it hard to be sympathetic with others. So
yeah, but I mean, this is so prevalent. It's not like it's a famine in another country. I mean, obviously that famine is a terrible thing, but there's a distance there that would fuel this disassociation. But this is, like, literally everywhere. You see the signs of it everywhere. So I just don't see how someone could be disassociated from it, unless, you know, as in many countries, you've passed to this post-quarantine phase, and then you think, oh, we're in the clear, let's get lax about things, you know? And also, the last thing we can say about it before going to the next part, what I think now as well, as I was saying, that, like, Madrid's very quiet, that, like, people are talking about emotionally, the emotional cost of being on lockdown and in quarantine, maybe there's isolation and maybe you're not working and there's a lot of things that, you know, you have to deal with. But I wonder if there's another lockdown, if that kind of vitality or that sense of solidarity will come back. Or will it be a very significantly lonely time for people? I think it is a very lonely time for people still, because things haven't gone back to normal in Spain or lots of places, but there's still relative freedom. So we've lost the impetus of like, we're all in this together, but we're still kind of grappling with the coronavirus. So this is the kind of long aftermath of the big events, even though the event is still happening, but psychologically, and I think a lot of people are probably still holed up more or less in their homes, and maybe they can leave, but it's probably still taking an emotional toll on a lot of people. But now these are also forgotten people, because in some ways we've moved on, even though it's still present, this epidemic.
No, I agree completely. I think to an extent certain aspects of it are worse now, because obviously the financial effects, I mean, I've driven past like two soup kitchens in the past couple of days, and the queues were like ridiculous, and you saw people, you know, that you can just tell that they're in need now, and it's not because they usually go to those places. But now, you know, they're out of work, or even like both parents, and they still need to look after the kids. I mean, a lot of situations are very complicated. So it's kind of like in different levels, in the practical level, and also if you're lucky enough to have work and even maybe to be able to go away or whatever, you still have this, I think part of it is like guilt or whatever, that, you know, a lot of people like are still having it tough, and you don't know. That's the thing with this, you never know if you're carrying it with you, if you're gonna give it to other people, if you move, whether you're gonna take it away with you to another place. I mean, there's a lot of issues to do with like social responsibility, I think, and also the unknown. At the end of the day, nobody knows, not being able to plan, nobody likes not being able to plan ahead. So yeah, but I mean, by all means, the most important thing is that things don't get out of control again, and you know, we have the tragedy that we've had health wise.
Yeah, I think there'll probably be a vaccine by Christmas. All things going according to plan, and then we don't have to worry about it. you know, but it's just a case of maybe if just this timeline, even when September rolls around again, October, November, they're going to be just funny months, you know. But what's interesting, just before we go to the next part, I was watching Border Patrol, Spanish airport, the amount of people bringing in like dead animals that could spread the Ebola virus through the airports, that they get caught, fortunately, you know, but
yeah.
It wasn't for these brave frontline defenders of the airports, we'd be eating bad food and having loads of epidemics around the place. But so yeah, that's the thing. That's part one, and what we'll do now is we'll have a musical interlude and we'll move to part two. So we went to a fantastic exhibition in La Tabacalera. Now, I know we did say that a lot of places are closed, but fortunately, a lot of places are still open, and this is free. Converted Tobacco Factory. We've been there before. We've spoken about it before. And now we were there to see an exhibition about, well, called Visit Spain. So basically 1955, 1965. Yes. And about the tourist campaign to lure tourists to Spain. And there's so much in this, because it's obviously Spain's shift away from self-reliance, being isolated, trying to boost the economy, and essentially repainting the image of Spain abroad. And it stuck, no? Because they wanted to have sun, sea, sand, and sand castles.
And bulls.
And bulls and flamenco dancers. And that is still, for better or for worse, the popular image of Spain abroad for a lot of people. So it was a campaign rooted in kind of the Franco's government shift to greater alignment with the international community. And as we just discussed, its consequences or its results are still visible today. So, yeah, so a lot of great photographs there. I enjoy it tremendously. Some great video footage there as well from Nodo. Now, you're the Spanish person, so Nodo is what?
Noticiero y documental. Yeah, news and documentaries, basically.
Yeah, so it's a great archival research or resource for people who want to see original kind of adverts and newsreels of...
Nodo was the name of the newsreel itself.
Yeah, like Pathé, no? Like British Pathé.
Yeah, exactly.
So you go to the cinema and you'd see these reels, newsreels, before you watch the movie. And that's what happened in Spain as well.
That's it. And what we saw was basically a combination of... Nodos from different years.
Yeah.
That was essentially it.
There's a hilarious advert for deodorant.
Yes, I actually had to check that later because I was like, really? Deodorant didn't exist until the 1960s? And I mean, it's not like it was invented at the turn of the century, but it seems that it wasn't made very popular, or it didn't become a household object in Spain anyway until the 1960s, which I find a bit, disturbing to think about, but hey.
Well, people in the past were smelly, weren't they? So
I thought you were going to say people in the past were always clean.
No, of course not.
No, I know. I don't know. I mean, especially in the heat of Spain, it's hard to think how that was managed, but...
Yeah, it's not something that stuck with me. You know, I thought it was a funny advert. Other people were laughing at it as well because it's like this woman putting it on and then there's no odor,
Yeah, and they're like, oh.
Yeah, I have no idea how it became or when it became a consumer product in other countries. Probably in America from the 50s and things like that, early doors. But for European countries, I have no idea. But we saw bullfighters, we saw athletes, we obviously saw... the kind of massive construction that happened in Madrid in the 60s, and also political things as well. And also, what I thought was really funny because, they had this documentary about Madrid traffic, or some kind of like newsreel about like going to work and everything as well. And it just stuck with me because it's so American as well. I mean, if you've seen the American things from the 50s, and even the 60s, they're almost like public service broadcasts explaining something that happens every day, So you already know about it, but they take a view of it for some reason, and then they kind of describe it in a very particular style and tone. And if you've ever, watched Jimmy Cagney movies on DVD from the 30s and from the 40s, you can see that kind of style as well. So I guess it was imported from the States, but it just something very much of its era, very dead style of reportage, of video. I don't even know what it is. It's not like it's not explaining anything new to anybody, but it's just kind of like documenting the humdrum banality of everyday life and just putting a lens on it. But you remember what I'm talking about, right?
Yes, yeah. I do. And we saw that video as well. It wasn't part of the exhibition. It was before when we were doing some research, but about time. And it was like, time.
Yeah.
It goes very fast, it goes very slow, and things like that.
Yeah, it's like, someone's rushing across the street because they have to go to an appointment, see the previa, or they are going slow, or it's 8 o'clock and the alarm clock goes off and they signify something. So it's like it's trying to attach a philosophical underpinning to the rhythms of an urban life. But now, this wasn't part of the exhibition either, but we've spoken before about Shane Mazzini coming here in 1969, and we were speaking today that in 1969 a lot of things were built in Spain. It's incredible. So you know more about that. What was built in 1969 that are emblematic of Madrid today as well?
Well, some of those are actually coming down. Funnily enough, one of them was in the news this week because it was just falling down and they had to bring it down, which was...
You're telling me Madrid Bridge was falling down?
Yes, kind of like... it's a bridge, isn't it?
Well, the Atocha Bridge, no? Yeah, it is coming down, yeah.
No, that one is the one that went... So, for example, lots of overpasses got built. And one of them was in the news this week because it was just falling apart and they had to knock it down, so they're going to have to restructure all that part. And in 1969, two of them were built. And one of them is not even there anymore. It got dismantled in, the early 90s or something like that. So, literally, there were structures or additions to the road that were supposed to make traffic more fluid, but in reality, they ended up being just a nuisance.
And poorly built as well.
Poorly built as well. It's, and they just, disappeared, like many other buildings that were built in that era, and, they weren't built properly.
Well, speaking of epidemics in part one, this is an epidemic of cowboy builders.
Yeah, I suppose that it's not such an alien topic to Spain. It's sort of like issue of cowboy builders. But it was kind of sold as a sign of progress and, how Spain was becoming modernized. And in the sort of videos that we watched, it mentioned things like the modern machine, is the tool that is going to bring progress. And there's all this talk of it's really weird because, it's late 60s. And they're talking about progress and about machinery as if it was the turn of the century,
Well, we've been to an exhibition before about, which had the same idea about New York, specifically in
That's
America.
That's exactly what I was thinking about.
And all the skyscrapers, but it's the 30s and the 40s.
Yes, exactly.
But it's because we were talking about this as well before the podcast, that, obviously in the 50s, Britain and USA had this material wealth, this economic boom, and that hit other countries later. And because Spain was isolated, so you're seeing things that were trumpeted and celebrated in other countries in other decades, but it's finally hitting Spain, and it's like a radical transformation of the country. What's interesting as well, we won't go into it because it's too big a story, but you're mentioning as well that you came across an article about a female prison that had Republican prisoners and then housed kind of not common criminals but just normal prisoners. And that got torn down in 69 as well, in Ventas, which is where the bullfighting ring is. And then at the same time, other things were coming up as well. So, symbolically and physically, it was out with the old and in with the new. The past is gone. It's forgotten about. We won't talk about it. And now that the modernity is coming and things like that. So, just the architecture and the construction was just very symbolic of a psychological shift in the country. Now, this exhibition was... made possible because, obviously lots of photographers and the government were behind it, but this particular exhibition was made possible because it was examining the work of one photographer who was quite happy to take pictures for the government and everything as well. Do you get a sense that he was also had a wry eye? He had a leftist eye, a Republican sense, yeah.
I think that was hinted at the exhibition, and I think it was, I think it's a good take because it talks about how he had an ironic point of view, and it's true that the main purpose of his photos, obviously, a lot of them are to promote Spain, but a lot of the ones that form part of the exhibition are actually before that. They're in the 50s and they're just documenting, there was a situation in different parts of the country. So really the shocking thing is that he's meant to be showing those things that are symbols of the country. So bullfighting, flamenco, things that have been sold over and over again. And even when, as you said, nowadays, still a lot of countries identify Spain with it. But I remember when I was little, that was very much so much more present. I mean, that was everything there was, like, in terms of, like, a culture, but also, like, to identify ourselves with it. So it was, like, kind of, like, that has changed a bit. But this was started or promoted in the 60s. And while he's doing that and he's focusing on those different things to promote to the tourists and to give that, you know, idea of openness and inviting tourists to come over, at the same time, you know, you can see kind of like a certain degree of criticism within it. Or there are certain things, I don't know, like, for example, like, there's a picture of like a Catholic school or adult school where the priest is kind of, you know, giving whatever instructions, and all you can see is kind of like his shadow. You don't really can make out his face, but he's got kind of like a threatening finger pointing at the people that are listening. And the people that are listening are two adults, and one of them has a face of like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And the other one's just looking at him as in, yeah, as if, you know. So, yeah, it can be accidental, but, you know, it seems that there's a certain like intentionality there where he's trying to show the shortcomings of the whole system. I think it's easy to see.
Yeah, I guess as well with the photographs about boxers, you know, on one hand you could say it's the virility, the masculinity of the Iberian male, but the lesser spotted, no. But you know, you have like a boxer on a treatment table, you have a boxer kind of in the shower after, you know, his head's kind of down and you can see his bottom, but he's kind of like, he's just, you know, wrecked after and everything as well. And you know, so it's not as if like there are boxers who are like the famous Ali shot where he's over, I think Joe Louis, I think, you know, he's on the canvas and Ali's just powering over him. It's just this amazing shot of a boxer in his prime dominating the man like he's fighting against. But in this case, it's just like men who are kind of like locked in this kind of struggle, maybe, but they're just, you know, they're ordinary men and like they've done their training and they're kind of tired as well, so it's just realistic, but it's not like making them into supermen. And then on the other side of those photographs, you have just very beautiful black and white shots of like a trainer giving instructions, or just the wire or the rope around the boxing ring and things like that. So it's like, you know, Clint Eastwood did that with Million Dollar Baby. He just created this very moody and kind of black and white shadowy tableau you get in the scenes in the boxing gym, and it's like Caravaggio or something like that, you know. But and it's a very beautiful movie to look at in that respect. And in the same way, these photographs are magnetic because they just have the perfect combination of light and shadow and a dynamic quality, and just capture just this kind of this cinematic kind of feel of this location, which is ironic because like most boxing gyms, I imagine, are pretty run down, you know, and kind of dirty as well, I guess, you know. So they're just kind of like, their buildings have seen better days, but you come there, there's no bells and whistles, you just train, you know. So so I think he's capturing those kind of humanistic and personal stuff, and it's not all for the glory of the country.
Yeah, I think that's interesting also because it makes you think about the whole topic of what goes on underneath, you know, everything that is kind of like clandestine happens underground, so like literally. So even like in that boxing context, I imagine that as, you know, kind of like, cellar or something like that, something that might not be seen like from outside. So maybe like boxing is not, there wasn't a problem with that activity, it wasn't banned, but there would have been many other activities going on underground then later on at even a political level.
Yeah, well, even because whenever there's a shot of the Guardia Civil, there's one where like he's with his son, and the son's just like has his shoulder on his, you know, he's kind of resting his kind of shoulder on his dad's shoulder, and then like he's like touching his hat. But all these figures from the Guardia Civil, the police kind of force, are, they're shot from behind. So like there's two guys just in the park and they're just like looking at the greenery. They have their guns and there's like a woman sitting down on a blanket or something enjoying the sunshine, or he's just in the audience with his son out of a bullfight, or they're just kind of like just they're there but nothing's really happening. So I don't know if it's kind of showing the police force at this time kind of with their eye off the ball, or it's making the argument that, well, this is not necessary anymore because it's been a few years since the Civil War and Spain's becoming wealthier and potentially safer. And like this, you know, maybe they're incongruous there. They don't fit into these different scenes because they're just kind of there placed awkwardly. I don't know what his intention was, but they don't fit the scenes that they're in.
Yeah, and I think those ones are harder to...
And they're very casual as well.
They are very casual. That's why...
Yeah,
in that respect, you're thinking, well, is this part of kind of like the propagandistic thing that he had to do of like portraying things in a, you know, all is good, all is safe, and it's a very relaxed atmosphere type thing? Or whether he was trying to kind of like diminish their role by just saying, look, they're just ordinary people, they're like nobodies. I don't know. I really don't know in that respect. Like, I don't know enough about the photographer to be able to make that analysis. But I think certainly in other cases, it's very obvious what he's trying to do. But also, I think you have to focus on like exactly what years this is going on, because it's very different, the photographs at the beginning, you know, early 50s, than what he's trying to show in the 60s. So, for example, the one you're talking about with the Guardia Civil, that's actually the 50s. So, you know, I can't imagine he was trying to show like this gentle image in the same way that later in the 60s they actually give him, you know, the task to do in order to persuade the tourists or whatever to come over. So,
well, yeah,
I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, when I say gentle, you know, I don't mean as in soft focus, these guys are great, you know, I'm not trying, he's trying to make that thesis, but what I'm trying to say is that maybe he's sending them up. It's like a satire, you know, and also making a broader political point, maybe more in the 60s that they're not necessary anymore, or they just don't fit the scenes, but maybe he's just satirizing them, that, you know, because it is a scary time, I think, the 50s, you know, and there's people do get disappeared and, you know, other things happen. We won't, and you had these guys then who are shot in such a kind of just peculiar ways, and probably back then as well, to see them like that was probably more impactful as well. So
one of the things that struck me about that picture is that I don't know, you said like they look out of place, but at the same time in that particular one in Casa de Campo, like where they are just sitting down relaxing, they kind of like blending in the landscape. Like at that particular time, it made me think that it's a bizarre scene for us now, but it would have been normal back then to constantly have them around.
Well, that's, yeah,
you know what I mean?
That's interesting, because we have spoken before, because we've done some, you know, reading around this subject as well for a project,
for something that we're not gonna say
exactly, but we could win 3,000 smackaroos, but anyway, the idea is that obviously the university students are famous in Spain for maybe even signaling the arrival of democracy, because they were taking on the state and specifically the police, and did gain some ground, actually, you know, but a lot, some students, I mean, the situation was, you know, people didn't talk about the Civil War, and even people that were leftist or Republican were like, look, this peace is far better than any Civil War, just do not touch the hornet's nest, you know, or just engage in any type of political disagreements. And then the young people who didn't remember the Civil War kind of grew up not really knowing it, and just assuming that, well, if someone's getting carted away by the police, then he probably did something wrong. But then once they started maybe getting involved in student politics, and then they saw someone or it happened to them, and they got a bat into the face, you know, they realized that actually this is a strong arm state, and it changed their opinions quite greatly. So yeah, so I think maybe you're right, you've hit the nail on the head there, that just for us it's kind of weird to see soldiers walking around, but maybe what it does show is that this was just this kind of tough side of the state, which is like a violent side as well, was just so normalized and part of the fabric of the city. So rather than actually being strange, it actually is just, it fitted perfectly. And that fact that it fitted perfectly is the strange part, you know? So, wow. Hashtag wow. Insight. There are, of course, other photographs in this exhibition. So can you tell me maybe another one that you enjoyed?
Okay, another one which I found very insightful was one of like three women that were selling or trying to sell embroidery clothes, things like that, on the beach. So all you could see was like the back of like these two, I presume tourists, because they were in kind of like rudimentary bikinis of the period, which it wasn't like, because this is actually the 50s, which really struck me. I mean, because both the fact that they appear to be, foreigners, and obviously like wearing these kind of things that they wouldn't wear in Spain. And they are, you can only see their backs, and basically the photographer is behind them and is just shooting these three women. And it's just like an amazing contrast, because the three women are dressed, you know, head to toe in black. So like many widows used to do here in Spain, full black outfits. But also some people from villages and so on, like, wore that kind of thing. So it's really peculiar, because the contrast is like so amazing. It's like two worlds that kind of like collide. So these people have appeared that seem like really casual. And it's almost like now when you're on the beach or whatever, and I don't know, an African man passes by and tries to sell you watches or something like that. In reality, it's the same idea. But when you're looking at the faces of those women, one of them is kind of like showing, you know, the embroidery, as in, you know, yet again doing this for the tourists. And another one is kind of like whispering to the other one, looking at them. So, you know, presumably, well,
gossiping.
Yeah, it's, you know, making any comments about them or whatever, or she's, I like, don't really know.
She's not beach body ready. What's she doing? That kind of thing.
I honestly don't know whether like they found it too shocking what they were wearing, or
what?
I don't know, something about their attitude they didn't like, but it just seems so, there was such a stark in contrast between the two worlds, you know.
Yeah, well, I heard, I don't know if it was in the exhibition or I read it in the research that we're doing, that that these people coming over, especially wearing bikinis or whatever, It was problematic in Spain. I mean, a Spanish woman couldn't do that until the tourists came over and they realized, oh, normal women dress like this. We're normal women. We can dress like this too. But before they saw like these tourists wearing them, they would have associated it with something scandalous or immoral or whatever. So in fact, seeing that was shocking at the start, but then it kind of normalized that fashion, and, you know, it kind of changed the conservative attitude that it didn't convey anything about that person's I don't know, morals or something like that, you know, or whatever you want to describe it. But so it kind of washed away the kind of connotations, you know.
I think the key thing as well as what you say, which is true, I think the key thing is a generational thing. So obviously, like, these women that were selling the clothes were older than the ones that were sitting down. Not that much older, but it's enough of a gap to, in that era, it sort of like jumps in a way that is enough, those 10 years between them, to be able to make it like so. And also because in the past, things like dress were far more codified. So, you know, a woman at a certain time of their lives, to a point it is now still, you know, like someone in the 50s wasn't going to wear the same clothes as someone in the 30s, you know. And for example, if a woman had lost her husband, she was gonna wear full black and maybe just forever, you know,
if she missed a husband, obviously. But
no, it was just, yeah, convention, you know. It was a way to show respect, but also like a way to identify,
well,
people's status.
But speaking of codification though as well, I think we remarked on this as well in the exhibition, you know, it's a weird thing, not just in Spain, but even like in France, you know, the Gaul didn't really promote the Breton language, for example. Now, not a lot of people speak it because he wanted to have a unified France and a unified language. And you kind of find that as well in other countries that regional languages kind of get squashed. Now, I'm not talking about languages in Spain, but, you know, kind of regional cultures were in some ways not, you know, depending on what they were, whether tolerated or prohibited by the regime. But what you do see in this exhibition is just a lot of examples of regional culture as well. So it kind of like begs a very interesting question about like what makes some regional culture acceptable and others not, you know, because you have these dresses in different places, you have flamenco, you know, and even bullfighting, which is like a national sport, if you want to call it a sport, is also something that's also very regionalized as well, and it kind of changes in different places that you go around the country. So I think there's like that kind of tension in the exhibition as well, if you allow me that observation.
Yeah, the regional differences, I'm not quite sure, because at the end of the day they are the same part of the same thing, because they are, you know, it's just focusing on flamenco, focusing on bullfighting, things that are certainly part of the culture in some regions, but there are other things that are completely missing of regional clothing and traditions from other areas that to date many people don't know, especially from the north, because that's the image that we export is based on, like, you know, southern traditions rather than northern ones, and many people are completely unaware of any Celtic links or anything like that from the north of Spain even to date. So that's it. I mean, yeah, there was one picture of like San Fermines, I think, but it wasn't really focused on the fiesta, and at the end of the day San Fermines is also bull, so it kind of like fitted the, you know, even if it wasn't the south, it fitted the narrative.
Well, San Fermín is not even Spanish anymore, it's so inundated with tourists, but
of course.
But that is, I mean, they also have like pictures of Charlton Heston filming El Cid in Spain, and also other kind of Western celebrities kind of coming over and doing business in Spain as well. So, yeah, overall, a wealth of images, very interesting, because you could see pictures of people playing football, even in the seminary, Madrid, like in very kind of ice, rough, like it's like a Wild West town. There's just like dunes and people are sitting on, you know, rocks, and there's like no buildings as such. So so you can see different and fascinating aspects of Spain. So that is enough for the exhibition, I think.
Visit Spain,
and a fantastic and wonderful exhibition. Okay, so will we wrap it up there? I think we're out of time. I don't think we have enough time for the book, so we'll leave that for the next podcast. So we'll discuss Alone in Berlin by Hans Falada in the next podcast. And we've heard of the phrase, the banality of evil, but this book deals with the banality of good. With that, of course, we will finish part two and move on to part three. Welcome back to part three of the show. Mary, do your thing.
So you can find us on our blog at irishsliceofmadrid.com, Twitter at elarpa1, Facebook elarpamedia. You can also check out our book website, fakenewsbulos.es, isn't it?
.com. That is, yeah.
Sounds
like BULLSHIT to me now.
It should have, like, I'm spelling it for like people that don't speak Spanish. So there you can find everything to do with the book. And that's it, pretty much.
Yes, it is. And just before we finished the paddle lads, we had the last game of the season, Sunday last. Turns out they've met Lady Gaga.
Gaga.
They've met Almenabar, what's his name?
Almenabar.
That's the guy. And they've met Derry Henry, Bex, you know.
Bex.
Who else did they see?
Someone that acted in Holby City.
Oh, yeah. Holby City. It's a good show. So I came to the conclusion, I have never really met a famous person. So...
Me?
Well, you, obviously. But apart from that, like, the logic is that if we can't identify the famous person you've met, you're probably that famous person for other people. So on that note, thank you so much for listening.
Reflect on
that. We'll leave you with that nugget. So thank you very much for tuning into this show, this particular episode. And we'll be joining you next time. This is me saying good luck.
And me saying bye.
The El Arpa Podcast. The home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.